Dear beloved Son, there is grace so undeserved. How can I ever sin against the one who makes my heart to sing? Create a heart so clean that like you I may be. As light of morning rises up with healing in its wings, my broken, contrite heart is so worthless in my sight. But you restore it. Give it peace and joy to love and follow you. Oh, may I ever strive to live pure in your sight, filled with your goodness, free to glorify and honor you. I didn't ask him to lead that song, but I think it's exceptional for what I plan on talking about tonight. If you were to go ahead and turn over to a passage that I'm sure we're familiar with at this point, 1 Peter chapter 1, and we'll start there in verse 13. I guess before we begin, I want to thank you all for the impact that you've been, that you've had on Karen and I in the 5 years that we've lived here. We're moving away from you, and I'll make this quick and short and sweet so that I don't burst into tears in front of you all, but we are sorry to leave. You guys have done so much for us, and we appreciate you all so much. And I pray that God continues to encourage you all and to motivate you all to continue the good work that you're doing here, because you have done us a great good. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13, it says, "Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Since it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.'" This year at Eastside, we've been studying holiness. And it's not just our standard of holiness or Eastside's standard of holiness. This is God's standard of holiness, and it's a high standard. Holy as God himself is holy. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 14, we're told that without this holiness, none of us will see God. It's a tall order. And God's design is to make us like himself. He wants to conform us into his likeness so that we can be in his presence. And he says here to be holy in all of your conduct, in your thoughts, in our speech, in our actions, in every area of our life, including our entertainment choices. Almost 3 years ago, I presented a series of lessons to this congregation. You guys were my guinea pigs. You were the first ones that I did this for. A couple of lessons about Christians and entertainment. And it was due in part to the unique experiences that I've had going to film school and being trained by the world. A few of you, including the elders, have asked me to present this again. Obviously, it's a shortened version. I'm not going to do two sermons worth of stuff tonight. But they've asked if I could present this to you all again. Since that time, 3 years ago, I've been able to present this in various other places. I've tweaked it a little bit. I've changed it. Hopefully, I've improved it. So I'm presenting it here again. If you want, you can you can think of this as like a relaunching of the franchise. We're going to start over again, make it better, and get the people who weren't on board the first time invested in this. I graduated from film school in Atlanta in 2007. And I had considered myself aware of the worldly environment that awaited me there. I thought that I was prepared for what I would encounter. But nothing really could have prepared me for the blatant and offensive disregard my fellow students, many of my professors, and the school administrators had for anything remotely godly. My English professor purported that God and religion were merely created by those in power to keep the masses under control. My script writing teacher spent two class periods and even assigned us a project based on the idea that sex sells. Needless to say, I left class early on presentation day. More than merely teaching us to construct films, we learned to construct ideas and to effectively communicate our messages to our audience. We learned how to educate you. We learned how to inspire you. We learned how to change you. And it wasn't until I sat at the feet of film professionals and heard them talk about film in this way, as a power to be wielded, a power to be used against other people, did I fully realize what many are still blissfully ignorant about. As filmmakers, we were not taught to merely entertain you. That was not our primary objective. We were taught to change you. My teachers taught us how to deceive and manipulate your emotions, your thought processes, and your opinions by whatever means necessary. They called us culture changers. They made the claim that we as filmmakers have more influential power and reach than many politicians, preachers, or motivational speakers. So I'm a filmmaker preaching to you, so I don't know how much power that gives me. But they said that we have more power than any of these people, because who else would you let talk to you, not talk with you, but talk to you for hours on end without interruption? Because that's what filmmakers are allowed to do. I say all of that to say, I hope that I can offer you perhaps a perspective that you haven't considered before, so that we can all of us, myself included, reevaluate our entertainment choices. And I wish I could say that I spent 2 years in this godless environment completely unaffected by the things that I was taught. I have watched films and television shows in order to learn my craft that I seriously regret, images and words and situations that still resonate in my brain and that Satan still uses against me 6 years later. And I pray that the message that I'm bringing to you can help you learn from my mistakes. Because contrary to popular belief, it won't ever leave. So tonight, we'll talk about Hollywood's worldview. We'll talk about us as Christians and our worldview. And we'll discuss some of the differences, and we'll talk about some of the methods that we as filmmakers were taught in order to communicate our messages to you. We'll talk specifically about God's standard, the standard that God himself set for our movie watching. Too many people say that movie watching standards, they're different for every Christian. And I would say to a certain extent that that is not true. Remember what we just read in 1 Peter chapter 1, holy as God is holy in all of our conduct. I'm not going to get up in front of you this evening and talk to you about Craig and Karen's standard of movie watching. I'm not going to talk to you about Eastside's standard of movie watching or the Church of Christ's standard of movie watching. Let's see what God says about what we put into our minds. And we'll address some of the common excuses that many of us have used in order to justify watching things that we shouldn't. And we'll make specific application as to how we can make better choices with our entertainment. So, a week and a half before we leave, I'm going to stomp on a bunch of our toes. And I pray that you bear with me, because know that I'm stomping on my own. One of the lessons, primary lessons that we learned in film school, is that we write what we know. When we're creating scripts, we're telling stories, we were encouraged to write what we were familiar with, to draw on our own personal experiences and use our own beliefs. Our worldview. And that's the convictions and beliefs that we use to interpret the world. Everyone has one. Not just religious people have a worldview. Everyone has one. So what is our worldview? What's the Christian's worldview? In Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, we know that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In John chapter 3 and in verse 16, we're told that God so loved that thing that he had created and those people that he had created that he did this amazing thing and sent his son to die for us, to give us a chance to fix that relationship that we had broken. Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 12. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 12. He says there in a little ways, it says, "But I am not ashamed, for I know whom I've believed, and I'm convinced that he is able to guard until that day what has been entrusted to me." Our worldview is that Christ is the absolute center of who we are and what we believe. Our overall perspective of everything that we encounter is interpreted through and seen through the conviction that God created the world. And that Christ, His Son, died to redeem us from our sins, and that heaven is our goal. That's how we view everything. That's how we view our jobs and our families, our relationships with everyone. Those are the glasses that I look through when I write what I know. Well, what does Hollywood know? What does the world know when they write from their worldview? It's summed up fairly simply in Psalm 14 and verse 1. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. What they know, what the world knows, is subject to change. It's constantly evolving and changing or de-evolving, depending on how you look at it. Someone like Darwin will come along and give some educated lies and change everything the world thinks they know about something. They live in a world where God does not exist. And if they do exist for some in Hollywood, they treat God with the same respect that they might give Santa Claus. He's this old guy out of reach who gives us stuff when we ask him. Let me give you an example. And before I start listing movies specifically, know that just because I've said it from the pulpit doesn't necessarily mean that I recommend this film or that I necessarily condemn this film. I'm using them as an example. You take Transformers and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, whatever version you want to take, and the old cheesy BBC version that was made 20 years ago. Hopefully not. Transformers starts in the first 30 seconds. You've got that booming voice of Optimus Prime. You've got this three-dimensional cube floating through space. And Optimus Prime says that before time began, there was the cube. And we don't know where it comes from, but the cube has the power to create worlds and fill them with life. Anyone catch it? In the first 30 seconds of Transformers, Optimus Prime is telling us, in this world, God doesn't exist. And you're thinking, what? He's a robot, and it's a cube, and it's space, and it's so cool. How could he possibly? In this world, this cube has the power that we know as Christians only God possesses. But in the first 30 seconds, while we're still settling into our seats and munching on our popcorn, He's letting us know that our worldview, God doesn't exist here. We don't need Him here. We've got the cube. In the Chronicles of Narnia, it's a fantasy world. It's a make-believe story. And yet, even in a story like that, there is a character of Aslan, a lion, who is the ruler of this realm, the son of a king beyond the sea, who sacrifices himself in order to save the people that he loves, in order to redeem these people. Even in a fantasy world, we can see that the worldview of C.S. Lewis was significantly different than the worldview of those who wrote Transformers. Turn to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and in verse 5. What's the big deal? What's the big deal? They've got a cube and we've got a lion. I mean, seriously, is it that big of a deal? In verse 5 of Romans chapter 8, it says, "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God." Proverbs 14 and verse 12 tells us that there's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end, it's the way of death. Even when filmmakers are not maliciously setting out to undermine God's perfect law, they are writing from a worldview that is contrary to God. And they are writing from a worldview that we're told here in Romans will lead to death. Why are we willingly allowing Hollywood to communicate such dangerous ideas to us? Well, the next point, I'll give you a reason why. Because we were taught as filmmakers to dress up the message. I know that my Christian audience, if I were to make this film, they wouldn't like me to preach to them and say point blank, I don't believe that God is real. So I'm going to dress it up a little bit, package it in a way that I know they will like. In Genesis chapter 3, Satan basically did this with Eve. We're familiar with the story. Satan came to Eve. His objective was to kill God's creation. That's what he was out to do, to separate them spiritually and physically from God. But he didn't go to Eve and said, I wish you would die. How about it? It's not going to work that way. Instead, he quotes back to Eve almost verbatim what God had said to her, but he adds a word, just a single word. God said, if you partake of the fruit of this tree, you will surely die. And Satan said, you will not surely die. Sounds good. It doesn't seem that harmless, but that word was enough to introduce sin to the world. Our teachers didn't use the story of Satan and Adam and Eve in order to communicate this lesson to us, but you get the idea. We were taught to communicate by whatever means necessary. Nothing was off limits. If we can do it in a way and you realize it's being done, but you're not bothered by that, we do it. If we have to lie to you so that you don't know until the credits are rolling what we've just done to you, we'll do it. They may not come out and tell you that God does not exist, that mankind came through millions of years of evolutionary process, that the story of a worldwide flood is nothing more than a fairy tale. They'll just wrap it up in various animated dinosaur cartoons like The Land Before Time and Ice Age, until even Christians have a hard time coming to grips with the factual historical record of the book of Genesis. Our children will be told that Darwin was right and God was wrong. They will not actually encourage you to rise up against those that God has placed in authority. They'll just make movies that depict authoritative figures as the oppressive totalitarians that must be overthrown. The rulers are often the bad guys. The Hunger Games, V for Vendetta, are movies like this. The moral of these stories is that if those in authority are bad enough, then rebellion, deception, violence, and murder are completely justified. In fact, they're encouraged. Evil justifies evil. They may not actually say that God's plan for the sexual relationship is outdated. They'll just teach us that casual sex, homosexuality, and adultery is the norm. It's even the ideal. And that their definition of love is justification for any kind of behavior. I started to write out a list of movies that depict this. I don't have enough paper. But shows like Glee, movies like The Notebook, series like Twilight, promote a love that is found nowhere in Scripture. And yes, there may be things about that may be helpful, that may be nice, but the love that they are teaching us to strive for and want is not the love that God tells us. Have I stepped on any toes yet? I've seen some of these movies too. They may not tell you that your parents are out of touch with your generation and are trying to keep the kids from having fun, but these will be the only kind of parents that they'll show to us. They may not tell you that violence solves every problem, but they won't offer you any other realistic alternatives. I am amazed what an explosion will solve. I mean, Michael Bay seems to think that's the only answer to any problem. We put ourselves in this situation, there's no way to just blow something up and it'll be okay. They may not tell you that they're trying to undermine God's perfect law. They'll just do it and we'll take it. We'll pay the $12, we'll buy the DVDs, and we'll tell them, give us more. Romans chapter 6 and verse 23 tells us that the wages of sin is death. Satan knew that when he approached Eve. And he didn't come to Eve and say, I want you to die. But that's what he wanted. So he wrapped it up in something seemingly harmless, like a piece of fruit. Satan wants us to die. He wants us to be forever separated from our God. And he knows, for the most part, that he can't approach us and say, leave God. Just drop it. Just leave this. It's not worth it. But he'll wrap it up in something seemingly harmless, like entertainment. He'll sugarcoat it. So I guess the question is, how much sugar-coated sin have we digested, wrapped in interesting characters, special effects, kung fu fights, and car chases? We must look past the dressing and identify the message. I am not an entertainer, I'm a communicator. They are not merely entertainers, they're telling you something. What are they telling you? Is this a God-glorifying message? We were also encouraged as filmmakers, you have to in this kind of industry, to count the cost. Movies are astronomically expensive. I still have a hard time wrapping my brains around how Spider-Man 3 could spend $300 million. They must have had some amazing catering, I don't know. But those producers didn't just say, let's make a movie and, you know, we'll figure out how we'll pay for this thing later. They had to sit down first and say, how much is this going to cost? How much is it going to take in order to get this thing done? With entertainment, there's more to consider than just how much lighter our wallets will become. The idea of cost is a purchase price of something. It's giving something of worth in exchange for something that we consider to be of equal value. I'll buy that loaf of bread for that amount of money. I believe that that's an even exchange. Sometimes I don't. But that's the idea of cost. We spend what we think that thing is worth. To ask what our entertainment really costs us is to ask whether we believe what we are giving away to be worth what we're getting in return. One of the ways that it costs us is obviously money. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 21. I'm sorry that I'm skipping through these verses so quickly. I'm trying to cover two sermons worth of material. Matthew 6:21, Jesus says that where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Where you put your money, where you invest your things, that's where your heart is. The amount we invest into something demonstrates how much we truly value the thing. So do we spend more on our entertainment than we do on the work of the Lord? Is our cable bill higher than our weekly contribution? If people were to merely look at the number, at the amount of money spent in the things in our lives, what would they consider to be the thing that's most close to our heart? Entertainment is expensive. And understand, before I go any farther, I don't believe that entertainment in its entirety is an evil thing that must be avoided at all cost. That you can't spend a dime on entertainment. But consider where your heart may be. It also costs us time. All of those TV shows, those video games, those books, and those movies, and movies seem to be getting longer and longer. I don't know, The Hobbit was like 18 hours long. It takes time. Do you know that the average person spends 4 hours in front of the television every day? 4 hours. Put it this way, that's 2 uninterrupted months of television a year. And that's not counting the time that we spend on our phones, the time that we spend on the internet, the time that we spend doing other forms of entertainment. 2 months of our year, we are being entertained. Is our entertainment of equal value to the children that we are ignoring while we finish that ball game or television sitcom? Is it more meaningful than the conversations that we need to have with our spouses in order to maintain a healthy and godly relationship? Is finding out what happens to our beloved characters of our favorite multi-season cliffhanging television show more important than relationships with real people? No form of entertainment is worth more than these things. Now, is any time spent on entertainment bad? No, not at all. There's a time to rest and a time to enjoy these things, but we need to strike a balance so that we're not neglecting the more important things. I think one of the main ideas of cost that I want to focus on tonight is our influence. Entertainment costs us influence. Turn to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2, starting in verse 7. Paul urges Titus to show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works. And in your teaching, show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. So how much of our influence, how much of the example that we set for others do we spend on our entertainment? One of the most common criticisms of Christ Church, and I'm sure that we've all heard it, the world accuses us of saying that we're different, that we're God's people, but they see us living just like the rest of them. We watch the same movies, we go to the same concerts, we read the same books. They call us hypocrites. We say that we're different, but they see so many similarities. Our influence on those that need Christ, the world out there that needs Christ, is weakened, if not completely lost, because of that movie that we just had to see, that TV show that we just had to finish. This passage here says that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. They may try, but they'll be put to shame because they won't have anything that can stick. How many evangelistic opportunities have we let slip by for our entertainment choices? Because remember, it is our differences from the world that will shine as a light in the darkness, not our similarities. We are calling people out of the world because we have something that they don't have. We're not going to attract them to us because we're so much alike. What about our brothers and our sisters in Christ? What about the influence that we have on them? And this is where it hit me square in the eyes. And my DVD collection got chopped in half. We need to consider more than just how a film might affect us. Will it affect our brothers or our sisters in Christ? If we realize that our brother's conscience is weakened, that they are encouraged to watch something that they have decided is not fit for them to watch, but they know that Craig saw it, and so they're going to go out and see that R-rated movie that Craig saw, that Craig owns, and their conscience is violated, they have sinned and I have sinned, because I've put that stumbling block before them. I have been personally ashamed to see my brothers and sisters come into my house and see the DVDs that are on my rack, or were on my rack. How comfortable would we be if the elders came over to our house and saw what we own? Or went through our Netflix queue and saw what we just put in that queue? Romans chapter 14, Paul warns those brothers not to destroy the work of God, our brothers, with something as trivial as food. It's just food. It's not a big enough deal to let your brother stumble and risk him sinning and being forever separated from God. It's not worth it. Not to do anything that would cause our brother to stumble. Are we causing our brothers and sisters to stumble because of a movie? It's just a movie. As a side note, I am so thankful to the Christian brothers and sisters, my parents, who came to me and said, "What are you thinking? You saw what?" To challenge me in love, to encourage me to think about what I'm putting in here, to think about the impact that I'm having on other people. We demonstrate love for our Christian family when we do this for one another. We don't do it in hate. We don't do it with, "Aha, I knew it. Shame on you, you evil, sinful." It's, "I am concerned for what you're putting in your mind. I'm concerned for the effect that it's having on you and on other people. And I'm asking you to reconsider." So let's talk about some of the common objections or excuses. Several of these I've used myself. Because it's possible that perhaps you're listening to this. It may be as early as the point where you heard me say entertainment choices and your brain went whoosh. I know he's going to say all of this stuff and he's going to challenge me, but it doesn't affect me. How often have we heard that? How often have I used that? You know, I know it's an R-rated movie. I know it's got a lot of language. I know the sex scene was 3 minutes long, but I tell you what, it doesn't affect me. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, we use this a lot in our young people's classes. Bad company corrupts good morals. Do you know that the people on your television set you're keeping company with? The people that you're seeing larger than life on that silver screen, you're keeping company with those individuals for 2+ hours. Bad company corrupts good morals. It's an inevitable result of surrounding ourselves with sinful behavior. Jesus taught in Matthew chapter 12 in verse 33. Let's read that verse. Matthew 12 starting in verse 33. The easiest and shortest answer to refute this excuse is, it doesn't affect me. Jesus says it does. Case closed. But let's read the verse anyway. Matthew chapter 12, starting in verse 33, he says, either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. For the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good person out of his good treasure brings forth good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure brings forth evil. When we fill our hearts and our minds with godless and sinful ideals, godless and sinful behavior will be produced. Jesus doesn't say it might happen. Watch out, be careful, this could happen to you. He says if you fill your minds and your hearts with these evil things will come out. And as a filmmaker, I love this excuse. It makes me chuckle. It doesn't affect you. I wouldn't be in this business if it didn't affect you. Commercials would not exist if entertainment didn't affect you. This industry wouldn't exist. It wouldn't have lasted as long as it did if we suddenly realized we're not affecting them anymore. Of course it affects you. We know that what you watch will resonate in your brain long after you have seen it. We're counting on it. What about this one? It's not that bad. You know, there's a scene in there, but it's not that bad. You don't see anything. Compared to what? It's not bad compared to what? Compared to worse films? Because you're probably right. It's not as bad as porn films that you can watch, surely. But what about compared to God's standard of holiness in all of our conduct? 75 years ago, a film came out called Gone with the Wind. Karen and I tried watching it. I tell you what, it bored me to tears and I couldn't take it. But 75 years ago, when this film came out, it did something that no one else had done before. It featured a single swear word right at the end of the film. And today's standards, we would even say that it was one of those not-so-bad ones. When this happened 75 years ago, people picketed theaters and boycotted the film in areas. How dare they do such a thing? When was the last time you saw a movie that had less than one swear word? Hollywood used to abide by a code known as the Hays Code. Anyone ever heard of it? It was done away with before Gone with the Wind. But the Hays Code was a moral code steeped in Christian beliefs that dictated what could and could not be featured in films. It wasn't like a rating system that simply tells us how bad it is. That's really all the GPG means. How bad is this film? The Hays Code prohibited certain things from being featured. And eventually, Hollywood producers got wise and realized we could still produce movies and people will still come and see this. We don't need that seal anymore. And suddenly the Hays Code became obsolete. And they tried a swear word 75 years ago. And it's only deteriorated from there. This one's my favorite. I heard this after I presented this lesson here the first time. I'd never heard this before. I was told, I'm aware that Hollywood is trying to manipulate me. I know what they're up to. And I'm mature enough in my faith to defend against it. I know they're trying to trick me. They're not going to pull the wool over my eyes. I see it coming, and that makes it okay. First, I'd pull out the passage, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall, in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. Knowing that there's a flesh-eating lion behind a fence doesn't make it any safer for us to cross that fence. Knowing that Hollywood's intent is to communicate godless ideals to you doesn't make it any safer for you to consume that. Now understand, not all of Hollywood is this way. Not everyone who gets behind a camera is out to deceive you and manipulate you. But even those of us who are trying to do something better, I'm still equipped with those tools. I still know how. And just because you know that sinful behavior is happening doesn't make it any safer. Rarely does God simply tell us to develop thicker skin when it comes to temptation. He doesn't say there are these things you need to watch out, so build up that defense, hold your ground, stand up against it. Rarely does he say that. More often than not, he says things like, flee sexual immorality, flee idolatry, flee the love of money, flee youthful lusts. Simply recognizing the danger does not diminish its harmful effects. We have to get out of there. So in conclusion, this is something that we as Christians must constantly battle. And I wish I could say that I've presented this material enough that I know and I've never seen anything evil since. It's something that we're constantly fighting against. We're fighting against it from the people outside, our friends and our families who may not have the same standards that we do. Unfortunately, we're also, sometimes, fighting from amongst ourselves. Christian brothers and sisters who don't believe in these standards, who don't think that it's a problem. We may be pressured to compromise, made to believe that these things are normal, acceptable, or not that bad. But I would encourage us all to stand our ground and to consider God's standard. You can't preach a sermon like this without mentioning Philippians 4:8. We're familiar with that passage. The first thing that we need to do when considering our standard is we need to start by asking the right question. And I have to catch myself sometimes with this as well. A movie's come out and I want to see it, and I start by asking, how much swearing does it have? Is there anything bad in there? And it's not an invalid question. It's a good question. But we need to first ask the right question. And the first question to ask is there anything beneficial in this movie? Instead of merely focusing on, is there anything offensive in this movie, first ask, is there anything beneficial? Will I be better as a person, a better Christian? Will I be encouraged to be a better moral individual? Will I learn something more about what I ought to do after I watch this film? Because if the answer to that is no, it doesn't matter how much swearing is or isn't in that film. Why would I spend my time in something that would not benefit? Secondly, we need to do our research. Just as we wouldn't blindfold ourselves and grab some random thing and throw it in our mouths and hope that it's fit for consumption, we should not just plop ourselves into a theater or sit ourselves in front of the television and flip through channels and assume that it's going to be okay. In this age of movie trailers and websites like crosswalk.com, parental reviews that are available on IMDb, the International Movie Database, equipment like TV Guardians and V-Chips and Clearplay, there is absolutely no reason or excuse to unwittingly allow ourselves to consume this stuff. and just hope that it's okay. Learn about the message and the content. And it's been interesting. Sometimes, you know, nowadays, not only do they have the trailer, but they have interviews with the filmmakers and the producers long before the film comes out. I've been turned off to going and seeing a particular film sometimes when I hear the filmmaker talk about why he made it. Because he'll start saying things like, you know, it's really important for me to get us to understand. And he'll start communicating some godless, worldly idea. And it may be a spotless film, but I don't want that communicated to me. I don't believe in that. Thirdly, does it pass the reality test? 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 22 tells us to abstain from every form of evil. So ask yourself this question the next time you rent a movie. Would you allow real people to do those things and say those things in your living room? How much clothing would you be willing to allow them to take off? How much sensuality would you be willing to see before you said, get out of here? Not in my house. I'm seeing some smirks. It wouldn't take much. How much profanity would you let them stand there and say before you said, you know, I don't want my kids to hear that. I don't want to hear that. How much violence would you need to see? How much blood would need to stain your carpets before you'd say, this is done. We're done. Because I tell you what, these days we're watching things in 3D. We're watching them in HD. Sometimes we're watching them larger than life in our living rooms. We're hearing it in digital surround sound. They are in our living rooms. They are right there doing those things. How comfortable are we to let that continue? Turn to Job 31. It's quiet in here. Job 31. Job says in Job 31, verse 1, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? Other translations say, how then could I gaze at a virgin? How could I do that? I've made a covenant with my eyes. Psalm 101 and verse 3, he says, I will not set before my eyes anything that is worthless. This is a promise, this is a covenant before God that we are making, not to put before our eyes ungodly things. And for those of us that are married, we've also made another covenant. Have you realized this? I promised to Karen that I would forsake all others. She's the only one. That means I'm not going to look at another woman in the way that I look at my wife. I'm not going to see any other woman dressed in a way that I'm only supposed to see in my wife. I made a promise to her. I made a covenant. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, and we'll end there. You guys just got the crash course. I appreciate you guys being patient. I apologize for my raised tone. Anyone who knows me, when I get excited about something, man, I'm passionate about something, if you know any of the members of my family, you know that that's a D-Hut trait. I'm not angry with you. I'm not condemning you and saying, I know that you're all just evil, sinful TV watching. I'm challenging all of us. Because I know firsthand what media is supposed to do to you, and I don't want it to happen. I don't want my fellow students to hurt you in the way that they are now equipped to do. So 2 Corinthians chapter 6, starting in verse 14. He says, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial, or what portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will make my dwelling among them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, and this is the invitation for us tonight, therefore go out from their midst and be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch no unclean thing. Then I will welcome you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. That's what we've been calling for all year here at Eastside. To be holy is to be separate, to be called out, to be distinct, to be different. And God is telling us to go out from their midst and to be separate from them. Don't touch their unclean things. Don't be partakers in those things. And only then will he welcome us. And he'll be a father to us. We'll be sons and daughters to him. We'll have this relationship with him that we all need, that we all desire. But we have to first be holy. We have to first be separate. So God in Christ tonight is calling you to come out from among the sinful world. And it's only when we do that that he will be our God and we will be his people. So God is calling us to holiness in all of our conduct. If there's something that we can do tonight for any of you, to pray for you, to encourage you, if you realize that you haven't yet made that decision to be called out from among the world, that you're still partaking in those unclean things, we can help you tonight to go down in the waters of baptism with you and allow Christ's blood to wash you of those things. If there's anything that we can do to encourage you in your holy walk with God, we encourage you now to come as we stand and sing.